I turned on the television the other morning. It was Saturday morning, and there was a children's show going on. And the show had a chorus of young children. I guess they were around Emma's present age, which is, what, 9? That'd be my guess. And they were singing, and the song they were singing was "Had a Call Hattie," you know, which is a song that's been around for years. I wondered, or I thought, certainly none of the children knew, and probably none of the producers of the television show knew, that "Had a Call" was a patent medicine. Once, one of these elixir kind of things that I think probably have a long history in the United States. Tonics and those sort of things. The other famous one was Geritol, and I think they contained vitamins and alcohol and iron, and and they used to be heavy advertisers, and they used to always talk about tired blood. That was a standard thing. They would fix up whatever that meant, tired blood. I don't think we see many of these around, although I bet if we go out in the rural communities, especially down south, you can probably still find some of these, although I think Had a Call and Geritol eventually went out of business, although at one time they were extremely popular and made tons of money for somebody. I've been searching my memory for the last several days to come up with a quote, and I know there must be a half a dozen. Surely Shakespeare had something to say, or Emerson, about what was strange or forbidden before or whatever is now acceptable. And maybe that quote, I'll run across it or think about it. I can invent one maybe right now. What was once forbidden is now required. That's the kind of thing I'm thinking about. What was once forbidden is now required. And I bring that up because Margo and I have both signed up with Hans's Gym, a local weightlifting emporium here in town. And we're now doing weight exercises, and we've both enjoyed it, and it's been kind of fun. But what's strange about it is, if you'd go back, oh, I'd say 50 years or so, or maybe a bit more, weight training was looked at in a rather negative way. It was a common story that if you lifted weights too much, you would become simply muscle bound, and the muscles would grow so much that it would squeeze off the arteries, and you'd simply have a stroke or something or whatever. And so there was, and in any case, boxes were forbidden to lift weights, I've read, and so weightlifting simply wasn't a common activity, and it certainly was not a common activity for women. It was unusual. I don't think, I said to Margo, I can't believe outside of a circus, I don't think you'd find one woman in 10,000 that was doing anything with any kind of weights, dumbbells or whatever. It just was a no-no. Well, now it's completely turned around. And Margo subscribes to a health magazine, and one of the articles in the health magazine, it's the title of it is something like, "How Come You're Not Lifting Weights?" So we've had this strange turnaround where at one time it was considered to be absolutely dangerous and certainly not feminine, and now in a woman's health magazine they're saying, "How come you're not lifting weights?" In this gym, I've noticed several women in the gym, I swear, they're lifting weights I can't lift, and they're pumping iron like holy baloney. And so what once was forbidden is now required. To continue on this theme, we see some other things, I think. One is tattoos. Tattoos were once terribly, nobody got tattoos except sailors. And of course, the story I heard when I was a child about tattooed is you daren't get one because tattoo needles carried all sorts of horrible diseases, and that's how syphilis was spread and that sort of thing. In fact, now, I'm not sure about this, but I think for a long time you couldn't get tattooed in New York City. It was just absolutely forbidden by the Board of Health. Now tattoos are widespread, and you see, certainly not everyone has them, but you see a lot of women have them, and on their ankles and shoulders and so forth. Earrings, another thing. You see a lot of men wearing earrings. The first person I knew wore an earring was Chris Papadopoulos, who happens to be a Greek, but who was a colleague of mine in the art department, and he wore a little teeny gold earring back maybe in the mid-60s, but now earrings with men are quite common. Finally, in this whole idea about what was once a no-no and now is okay, as I heard a futurist woman talk, and she claimed, although I haven't seen any evidence of this, but she claimed that within a few years, men would be wearing nail polish, and it would be a widespread activity or widespread thing for men to wear nail polish. Margot has worn evening gowns. She did, you know, when she was a young woman. I made a list of things that I've never worn, and Margot is sort of in line with this list. I've never worn a tuxedo. I've never worn a bow tie. I've never worn skis. I've never worn hip boots. None of these things Margot's ever worn either. I've never had a door answered by a butler. So I don't know whether my life is deprived or what, but in any case. Today is Kathy's 41st birthday. It's October 6, 1997. And she gave us a ring. She was just had a new German Bosch dishwasher installed in her house by her friend. And they were going out to eat Indian food, curry and all that. I thought that was really nice. And I told her, I just sort of reminisced a little bit with her and said to her, well, we've come a long way and you've done pretty well in 41 years. I remember way back when you were a little pile of rags on a gurney, I think is what I said to her. And she didn't say anything about that, but the story didn't mean, that comment didn't mean anything to her. And she mentioned this, I guess, when she talked to Margot later, I was surprised when Margot said, well, but she never heard this story. And it's a rather famous story with the two of us, and it's been in my memory now for 40 years or so. So I think it's time Margot told the story.
Kathy had her tonsils out when she was just a little bit over 2 years old, and she was just a tiny little child. And we had to take Kathy to the hospital the night before, and she spent the night there. And we had to go home and spend a terrible night waiting for this. The operation was to take place first thing in the morning. The doctor had told me, if you will be in the waiting room outside of the operating theater at such and such a time, I will come out and talk to you about the operation. So Quentin and I were rushing to get there, and we were running late as usual. But Quentin dropped me off at the hospital door, and he went to park the car, and I went into the waiting room, thinking that perhaps the operation was already over and the doctor would be there. However, he wasn't, and I was waiting for Quentin to come and waiting for the doctor to come and pacing back and forth. And I heard this gurney coming down the hall. And I went to the door of the waiting room thinking, maybe that's Kathy. And Quentin was coming down the hall from one direction, and the gurney was coming from the opposite direction, and they were heading toward each other. When the gurney went by me, there was just this little bundle and this great big huge adult gurney. Only I saw Kathy's little face peeking out. She was sound asleep, of course, but I could see her little face. And the gurney continued on down the hall, and Quentin passed the gurney. And as he came up to me, standing in the doorway of the waiting room, he said, "What on earth were they doing rolling that pile of rags down the hallway on a gurney?" And I looked at him and said, "Quentin, that pile of rags was your daughter." And ever since then, we have talked about the pile of rags on the gurney that really was Kathy.
I think we should provide some background on this tonsillectomy. And I was just talking to Margo when she was refreshing my memory. But what it was, the story ran something like this. Kathy was sickly. She would get sick, and then Margo would take her to the pediatrician, and he'd give her a shot of penicillin, and she'd get better. And then she'd get sick again, and be another strep throat, another penicillin. And we were absolutely locked in this, and she was sort of a fragile-looking thing, and skinny, and I guess you'd say sickly. Finally, the pediatrician said to Margo, "Well, you just have to have this kid's tonsils out." And Margo, even today, remembers how reluctant she was to have this done. She really didn't want to do it, but she had to go consult a pediatrician at Fort Carson, and then and a surgeon, and finally, she thinks that, well, the three of them, the two pediatricians and the surgeon, was sort of on the phone together, and I wouldn't say in cahoots, but they knew about this, and the surgeon readily agreed that this should be done. So she had her tonsils out, even though she was extremely young age to have this done. But it really is, in a way, a happy ending story, because Kathy, really did bloom after her tonsils were out. They just made all the difference in the world, and she got out of that cycle of sore throat, penicillin, well for a while, sore throat, so forth, and really she did bloom after the tonsils were out. But that's why we had them out at such a young age, even though they grow back, I guess, and I guess with Kathy maybe they have a little bit anyway.
Yes.
While we're on the subject of tonsils, I'm fairly sure that I have a clear memory of having my tonsils out, I think with my brother. I think we had it done together. And I have, an incredible sense of place memory, and yet some other memory kinds of things. My memory is not very good. I don't remember names really well. People's names and that sort of thing, even when I know them for a while. But I have a sense of a memory of place, and I could find the hospital, if it's still there, in Jersey City, where my tonsils were taken out. I can remember the bed I was in, the kind of iron railing bed. I remember the nurses. I remember this big room we were in, and my brother was in another bed. I remember it was absolutely terrifying. I don't remember much after that or anything, but I do remember being in that particular hospital. And as I say, I'm telling you, I could find that place in a moment if I were in Jersey City. Chapter 14 in the Tonsillectomy Saga by Margo.
I had my tonsils out, I think, maybe when I was about, 5 or 6. Maybe I was older, but I don't know. Anyway, I had been sick a lot. I had had pneumonia a couple of times, and I was really very, very sick. So the doctor said, "Out with the tonsils," because in those days, that's what they did. They took your tonsils out if you were a sickly kid. even if you weren't.
The doctor was Medveski, is that right?
Right. So, also in those days, you did not have to go to a hospital. And my tonsils were taken out at home on the kitchen table. And they brought to the house some kind of anesthesia and put me on the kitchen table, put me to sleep, and took my tonsils out.
I think it was ether?
I have no idea. And then they promised me that when I woke up, I would be able to have all the ice cream in the world that I could eat. So when I woke up, my throat was very, very sore. But I said, anyway, I want my ice cream. So they brought me ice cream, and I immediately proceeded to throw it up. Therefore, I learned all adult promises were bad. Don't believe them.
This is postscript to chapter 14 of the tonsillectomy epic.
I don't remember exactly when this happened, but somehow I think it had something to do with tonsils being taken out. And I think it was they wanted to take me to the doctor to have me checked over prior to the tonsillectomy. And I decided I was not going to have my tonsils out, and I was not going to the doctor, and he was not going to check me over, and none of this was going to occur. And I figured out that the way I could do this was to hide. Now, my father was what we called in those days an undertaker. And lining the walls of our garage were boxes holding caskets. Now, the boxes didn't fit tightly together. And a very small person could often find a way to slide in between the boxes and behind the boxes. And they could hide there forever, and nobody would know where they were. My family, however, knew that this was a favorite hiding place of mine. When I wanted to be alone, and I did not want anybody to bother me, and I wanted nothing to do with people, I went there and hid. So I went there and hid. And they came in the garage screaming and yelling and pleading with me and promising me all kinds of things, including all the ice cream in the world I wanted to eat.
Tonsillectomy story. I soldiered with a man named Harold J. Severance. He was older than I was by some years, kind of an old codger. Born, I think, in Kansas, and Margo and I knew the family, and they had he was married to a Japanese woman, and they had a really nice, bright son and so forth. He eventually retired. He worked in the post office. He delivered mail for years and years and years, and then I finally quit that. We corresponded, not much, but usually at Christmas time, over the years, and his handwriting, he always wrote his Merry Christmas and all this, we're doing fine or whatever, and we watched his handwriting deteriorate. Finally, the letter stopped, so I don't know whether, I suppose he's dead now, I'm sure. He was a World War II vet, but he told me an adult tonsillectomy story. He said he was a young guy, and he had throat infections, and he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, we got to take your tonsils out. If you come in the office, I'll just do this. You know, we'll give you something local and or whatever. And he asked around. He found a woman, said, do you know this Dr. X? Is he any good? Oh, she said, oh, God, he's a wonderful fella. He He's so gentle and understanding and patient. He'll listen to you, and you can't beat him. And I had my tonsils out with him, and oh, he was just wonderful. So Severin's went to have his tonsils out, and he wasn't unconscious. He was, you know, some kind of local thing, and Severin's was kind of going gagging. And the doctor said to him, "Quit your goddamn gagging." I really can't get off this topic. If Margot talks enough on tape, she'll find out she spent probably 3/4 of her childhood hidden behind coffins and in closets and whatever. And if you had known her mother, I was just thinking, they would have had to use tear gas to get me out of the garage from, I mean, I wouldn't. Oh, she would say, "Quentin, you get your ass out here." I'd say, "Come and get me, Mother! I'm not coming out alive!" First memories. Supposedly, your earliest memories are insightful in some way, I guess, but who knows? Everything's insightful. I think my earliest memory is... I've always said for years, my earliest memory was a movie. And I remember the movie, it was Joe Penna. He was like a vaudeville comedian, I think. And the name of the movie, I guess, was the 6-Day Bicycle Race. And I have just these barest memories of this movie, just a few scenes in it. You know, in the 30s, they had all kinds of, I don't know what you'd call them, marathon events, like they had dancing contests where people danced for 7 days to absolutely collapse, and like 6-day bicycle races. Joe Penna, I guess P-E-N-A maybe, was a, he certainly wasn't, he was an unimportant actor, but I think he was just like a vaudevillian and made some movies. I have no idea when this movie was made. I suppose sometime in the 30s. It might be interesting to find out. It might be interesting to see the movie. Margot will tell you briefly about her earliest memory.
Oh, my earliest memory is of being babysat by my sister Aileen, who was later killed in an automobile accident. And I can remember her sitting on the couch, and she was trying to read, and I was crawling all over the couch and teasing her and bothering her. And finally, she just stopped and played with me, and then she sat me down and read to me. I remember that very well. P.S. That must have been a very early memory, because I believe that she was killed when I was very young, maybe 2 or 3.
We don't own the world. We have borrowed it from our grandchildren. My latest memory is supper, which I just ate. Rishi Ibishi, which was rice, Italian rice, I must say, and green peas, plus Spanish grilled shrimp with olive oil and lots of garlic. And that's my most recent memory. I forgot we had a tossed green salad with tomatoes, scallions, and a really wonderful homemade dressing. So, you see how your memory just sort of fades away. I plan to make an off-colored, I decided to stay out to tell you. I plan to make this an off-colored, dirty joke, incredibly filthy story tape. We're going to do this separately. This will be definitely X-rated. And I'm going to work on this. I don't know when I'm going to do this. But the other thing is, I just want to, a funny thing occurred to me, or a memory occurred to me today, was There's a song out right now. This is October 97. It's like I'm a Barbie Girl. I'm a Barbie Girl. You know, it's done in this electronic music thing. I heard it today. But I thought that this incredible little one-liner is, she's had more hands up her dress than a Barbie doll. The Germans have a great word, Erstatz. Well, we have it. We use the word now. It's a part of our language, I guess. And it really means fake, if you want to make a case. It's like fake whatever. Erstatz coffee is not coffee. It's made with like barley, roasted barley or something. That's the idea of Erstatz. Well, there's really butter. There's an Erstatz butter. It's called oleomargarine. Of course, now it's widely used because some people think it's healthier. I don't know when oleomargarine started. Surely I remember it as in Florida, so that would put it back in the late 30s anyway. But in any case, the butter cartel, or whatever you want to say, in the country, the butter farmers, the dairy farmers, they ensured that, passed laws, I guess, I suppose a federal law, you could not buy colored margarine. In other words, the margarine you bought came in a white block. It looked like a big chunk of lard. And then it came, what accompanied it was a little packet of color, powdered yellow color. And I remember, and Margot remembers, I think, our mothers kneading with a fork. Margot did this, she said. Work this yellow powder into this lardy looking stuff and to make a yellow margarine. So, in other words, you could not go like you can today to the store and buy margarine that was yellow colored and looked like butter. It was white, and then you had to add your own color. That was obviously meant to be to discourage you from buying a margarine and instead buying butter. But what happened is when World War II came along, then they rationed all sorts of things. What they called points. They had so many points to buy a chicken or whatever. And one of the things that was a point thing was butter, because butter was, well, you had to have so many ration points to buy butter. People didn't want to spend ration points on butter. They wanted to spend ration points on chicken or whatever. So I think as a result of World War II, then the law was rescinded and you could color oleomargarine. But this was dreadful looking stuff. And, you know, I remember my mother taking a big Pyrex bowl and blending this in with a fork, and then what you had is you had this big mess of oleo in the bottom of a bowl, actually, but it was meant to be that way, so you wouldn't buy it, I think. P.S. number one, oleo. Somebody recently did some work and published it, I think, in the local paper or in a newspaper. Really weird laws that are still on the books, although nobody pays much attention to them. And one of the laws they brought up, and I think this was in the Wisconsin, states unimportant, was that two things. If a restaurant served oleo, it had to be served in a triangular patty. Couldn't be a square, like blue squares, a rectangle for butter, had to be triangular pattern. And then the law also specified that in the front window of the restaurant, or at the entranceway in any case, had to be a sign of large size, that they even gave the dimensions, which said, this restaurant serves oleo.
So margarine.
Margarine, okay. Anyway, now Margaret wants to do footnote number two.
Footnote number two, Quentin keeps calling it oleo. It used to be called oleomargarine. It is no longer called that. It is now called simply margarine. And I think that's because the oleo was, it has a bad sound to it. It sounds crummy. But to get back to the fact of mixing this blob of white lard-looking thing with a packet of yellow powder to make it yellow, that was my job in my family, and it certainly worked for me. If the butter industry wanted to turn me off about margarine, they succeeded 100%.
Footnote number 3, you really shouldn't deprecate lard too much. It's horrible, and nobody eats lard anymore. But however, there's no pie crust like a lard pie crust. Lard makes the definitive pie crust. Now, I know all you people listening to this have never eaten a lard pie crust, but that is absolutely the best. It makes it perfectly flaky and just grand. I also noticed that they sell lard now in our grocery store, and it's purchased apparently by Mexicans, just like they're starting now to sell tripe again in our local Albertsons, and I think that's because the Mexicans eat a lot of tripe. Footnote 2B. One of the, I think one of the really effective little slogan things ads I heard years and years ago was an ad for butter. You know, butter tastes better and all that stuff. But one of the things the ad said is, we never claim to be taste as good as Oleo. And it's really true. Oleo does not taste as good as butter. Margarine is margarine, and Oleo margarine is Oleo margarine, and butter is butter. And now, a musical interlude.